Which gets us to our mountainside chat, which I've been looking forward to for, well, I think since we first met. So welcome.
Thanks very much, Rob, and it's an absolute pleasure to be here. Looks like an absolute great turnout overall, and look forward to getting in the guts of the discussion overall and explaining a little bit more about myself and IPCO.
Yeah, well, that's what we're here for. We're going to get to International Petroleum, the company you lead, shortly. But I wanted to start with you, and maybe you could describe where you grew up and perhaps some of the one or two formative experiences that led to you getting into the natural resources business.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm born and raised in Vancouver, British Columbia. My family and my father, my mother, and I had a few other older brothers, three older brothers overall, and they moved from Dubai in 1989. And so my dad was actually working for the original International Petroleum Corporation at the time, which was headquartered in Dubai. At that period, he moved to Vancouver with the thought of going to a mining project and working in Vancouver for a couple years, and he ended up spending almost 20 years in Vancouver. I was born there as well as my brother. And overall, you know, working in the natural resource space or growing an affinity to work in that space overall just came very natural to me. And so, you know, while I was growing up, you know, whether it be sitting in boardrooms at a very young age or going on family trips, my grandfather at a younger age and being around my father, they both had kind of larger than life type of kind of spirits within them that were very captivating, let's say, and lots of storytelling, and people would always want to be around them, and they seemed to always be talking about work, and it just came natural, the work element and the personal lives as well. So it just completely intertwined into one another, and that's as far back I can remember, and which is, you know, super important. I'm fortunate for myself to be working in an industry that I am in and have that desire and fire in the belly to be within it, because if you're not liking what you're doing, it's going to be very difficult to be successful in that field or space. And, you know, in terms of the early days, you know, when my grandfather was around and he started with wildcat exploration, we didn't have a lot of money at the time when he was getting up and building his businesses. And so, you know, the risk appetite might have been a little bit higher than it is today. And also, you know, when he looked at Ian and Lucas, which were two of his four kids, his sons, he said, you know, Luke, you're going to be in mining, Ian, you're going to be in oil and gas. And, you know, they were kind of cast and they knew exactly what they were going to do, and they didn't have much of an option because we didn't really know many people at that time, or my grandfather didn't. And so it was important to, you know, have those people and family members that you could trust and work into that space. And then growing up, you know, through a generation, you know, they have managed to have quite a lot of successes, discoveries, build vehicles, and, you know, get a lot of professional expertise and people within the group overall. So that wasn't quite as big as a requirement in the early days as it was, as it is really now and for us growing up. And so my father didn't really push any of my brothers and I to go into the family industry, because he knew a lot of people and professionals and didn't want to make us do something that we didn't want to do. So I was thankful that I was really interested to do that. And I knew, you know, petroleum engineering, you know, whether it sounded cool or, you know, just seeing that my grandfather and, you know, my uncle had been doing that a lot, it made me interested to work in that field. And so from a very young age, I was, you know, doing summer jobs in high school and through university. And after university, I ended up working as a field operator / field engineer in Onion Lake, which is an asset that actually happens to be in our portfolio today. It was under a different company at the time while I was working for them, under a company called Black Pearl Resources. And so, you know, I finished my university. I did in the East Coast of Canada. I was a mineral resource engineer. It had some petroleum engineering attributes within there. And then going to the field and just north of a place called Lloydminster in it saddles Alberta and Saskatchewan, and working at a site in Saskatchewan called Onion Lake. That was quite a formidable kind of experience for myself, because I, you know, really got to get into the weeds of understanding about, you know, how operators' mindsets are at the field, how the communication works from the field to a regional office level in the company. And then also, you know, it's like in the winter, it'd be minus 40 degrees Celsius, and you got to go out, you got to do your rounds, you got to check all your KPIs, and the plant shuts down in the middle of the night, you got to get back up and going. So that was pretty formidable experience in understanding that.
It's definitely a tough environment, minus 40 degrees, and I had the opportunity to speak with your former boss from that time, and I asked him obviously about you, and he said, I don't remember very much. He just got things done and kept his head down. And I mean, I think that speaks to your humility as a human being. So that's wonderful. You touched on your family a little bit. We want to concentrate the discussion on International Petroleum, but it's such an interesting story. Maybe you could just set the scene, some of the other businesses your family own and how they, and the role your grandfather played in starting those up.
Yeah, absolutely. So Lundin Group, today there's 12 publicly traded companies. They're all independent from one another. The common theme is that the Lundin family is typically the largest shareholder, and we'll also have either direct family members and or Lundin Group professionals that have been within the Lundin Group for a long time, making up the management and the board of directors. And so those two criteria are really what constitutes a Lundin Group company. And so today there's about 9 of these companies are mainly mining, and 3 of them are energy focused. So the mining companies, we're doing copper, doing gold, I mean, there's a little bit of nickel,
silver.
There's
a really exciting development in Argentina and Chile, maybe.
That's correct, We have had a lot of vehicles in Argentina and Chile, and there's been a lot of business adventures through many, many decades and multiple generations within the family. And so today, company Lundin Mining, which is really the flagship mining company within the Lundin Group, has quite a few assets now in something that's called the Vicuña District, which is, in the Andes and saddles the Chile and Argentina border there. And so there's significant copper, gold, silver discoveries that have been found. And they also have producing mines in Chile called Caserones, as well as Candelaria. And so this is something we like to say is the future of really mining in general, because this is the most prolific, undeveloped kind of area and mineral endowment in the world that hasn't been accessed yet. So super exciting area.
And of course, copper is absolutely essential for electrification, so playing a big role in the move towards clean energy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And we're positioned quite well on that spectrum with respect to, copper. They say it's, the new oil. I think oil's going to be around for forever going forward still, but it's nice to be on both sides to get the exposure.
So it's a mixed crowd here. We have some expert fund managers who I'm sure have read your annual report back to front multiple times, but we also have doctors, lawyers, who perhaps don't know who International Petroleum is. So why don't you say a few words about International Petroleum is?
Absolutely. So International Petroleum Corporation, we are a diversified upstream oil and gas company. We have about 500 people in the company, including contractors. Our headquarters are in Switzerland, and we have assets in Canada, Malaysia, and France. We're a publicly traded vehicle under the ticker symbol IPCO, trading on the NASDAQ Swedish Stock Exchange, as well as the TSX. And so we're a company that was formed by way of spinning off the non-Norwegian assets from Lundin Energy back in 2017. So we started with just assets in France and Malaysia, and really were given the growth mandate to be the kind of international oil and gas vehicle within the Lundin Group. So essentially, some of these assets weren't maybe getting enough love and attention that we deserved, and not enough value being assigned to them from the market. And the growth in Norway was becoming quite significant with some major discoveries in Edvard Grieg and Johan Sverdrup. So, something that's a classic thing within the Lundin Group, which is, spinning off vehicles or acquiring new vehicles when maybe you're not getting value that you feel you deserve. And so the management team, board of directors, and really has followed through on that vision, and ended up doing multiple acquisitions in Canada to growing the portfolio today, where now we're around just under 50,000 BOEs per day in production, just shy of 500 million barrels in 2P reserves, over 1 billion barrels of contingent resources, and we have a net asset value right now of around $3 billion US, and we're about 1.5 billion USD market cap. We're in, a bit of a transition zone right now as a company, as we're building out a major organic growth project, which is really going to transform the company and take us to new heights. really strong balance sheet at this time with low leverage. We've been able to buy back our shares because we feel that we're very undervalued through our whole development project, which I'm sure I'll get into a little bit more detail as we continue the discussion.
There's so many strings I'd love to pull on there. Let me start though with, I think people would love to hear the Lundin Energy story and how that led to International Petroleum. Why don't you tell
us about that? Absolutely. No, it's a great story and a major value creation story there. And so if we take it all the way back, I touched on the original International Petroleum Corporation, which is a company founded by my grandfather. That vehicle ended up merging with a company called Sands Petroleum, and I believe it was the mid-1990s, around 1997, to form a company called Lundin Oil. And then Lundin Oil, their main asset was in Malaysia in a PM3 block. It ended up getting taken over by Talisman for, you know, just under $500 million. And it was around 5x in terms of the initial share price to the final share price, and crystallized good value there. After that transaction had taken place, still had a very talented management team and said, you know, let's do this again. So in 2001, Lundin Petroleum was formed, and there was one equity raise. It was the only one in the life of the company. It was for around $50 million at the time. And what they did is they grew through acquisitions. So they ended up doing a deal with a bank called actually Coprex at the time. They acquired some assets, one of them being in France that is actually in the IPC portfolio today, as well as they did another deal in a couple of years after in around 2003, 2004 with DNO. And that's where they got a lot of acreage and access to a talented team in Norway, which ended up leading to some of the discoveries in the Norwegian continental shelf of the likes of Edvard Grieg and Johan Sverdrup that I'd mentioned previously. So this company grew from 3 SEK a share to over 400 SEK of share. And there was an immense amount of value created. Exactly, it was about 100x in terms of the value creation within this vehicle through time, and around 1.6 billion in dividends was thrown off through the vehicle in over 20 years, and it ended up being sold for. It was around $14 billion in total enterprise value. So it was a big for cash and shares to Aker BP in 2022. So that was a huge, huge deal for the family. Essentially, you know, we saw phase one of Johan Sverdrup coming on stream. And, you know, there's a bit of a view that, you know, we're peaking production.
So Johan Sverdrup being...
Johan Sverdrup is actually, it's an elephant discovery in Norway. And thanks for pointing that out. This field is doing around 750,000 barrels of oil per day. So it's one of the biggest producing oil fields in the world in Norway. And our team was responsible for really making that key discovery in the formation out there offshore. So very, very big deal, a ton of value creation. And on the back end of that company being sold, the Lundin family still has about 14.5% of shares in Aker BP. You know, it's not considered technically a Lundin Group company, because BP and Aker are, you know, the biggest shareholders within the company. Of course, it's a very important financial position for the family. It throws off a lot of dividends and has a lot more growth projects coming on stream, which is quite exciting. And we do have the chairman of IPC also sits on the board of Aker BP. So it's an important company within the portfolio.
Yeah, and I should add, I announced it a few days ago that RV Capital is also invested in Aker BP now. So we're partners. We're not quite as big as you, but we're working on it.
Yeah, I saw that. Well timed. It's been quite a start to the year in terms of oil prices and overall equity prices for oil and gas names.
Yeah, it never ceases to amaze me how volatile the oil price is, but the companies as well. Intuitively, you would think people have an assumption on the oil price over the next decades and they discount that and value the companies, but no. If the oil price goes up, the share prices go up, and if the oil price goes down, the share prices go down.
That's right. It's a very volatile industry, one that's supremely difficult to predict and anticipate, and obviously a huge market. And I think what's super important is that, you know, the way you run the company and a core philosophy within the Lundin Group, and especially with IPC, is, you know, keeping your costs as low as reasonably possible, keeping a strong balance sheet. If you have, you know, cash on hand, it can be helped to be flexible, because when there's a low point in the cycle, having, you know, capital availability to be able to either make acquisitions when assets are at suppressed prices or just be able to weather the storm is super important. So, you know, that's where within our company we have a lot of quick payback opportunities and we could be spending much more money than we are spending despite us already spending a lot on our Blackrod project. But, you know, you got to have a prudent mindset when you're running a business.
We'll get to Blackrod for sure. But I think it's a great point you made. I think one of the things that frightens people understandably about oil and gas is the cyclicality. But when you have a great capital allocator that makes sure they have cash at the bottom of the cycle and sells prudently at the top, then it can be your friend, the cyclicality.
Absolutely, totally. And it really helps when you have a major shareholder that is there within the company. The Lundin family accounts for around 1/3 of the total shareholding within IPC. And so, you know, having that cornerstone shareholder and understanding that, you know, this is a long-term game, this isn't a short-term gain. And to have that backing behind us and understand that, you know, meaningful value creation doesn't happen overnight. And so having that support and being able to see that through and have the, you know, that you're going to make it through the cycles is really quite important.
Yeah, and cyclicality or playing the cycle well is a great segue to my next question is, you know, in the same way, I think Lundin Oil started with very little and built it up over time to where you were able to sell for 100x. International Petroleum also started as a tiny company when it was spun off, and maybe you could describe some of the capital allocation moves you made to make it the company it is today.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, IPC, when we started life, we were, you know, just around $400 million market cap or just under that. And so we have had about a 4x since we've started life. And, you know, we're only doing 10,000 barrels per day. We had around 30 million 2P reserves. And so, as I'd mentioned, some of the metrics earlier, we're very small. But the fortunate piece is because we were spun out of Lundin Energy, we were born debt-free. We still had high quality production, so we were able to leverage against our existing asset base and then do some meaningful acquisitions. So since the company has formed, we've done a total of 5 acquisitions, total consideration around $940 million USD in terms of the cumulative money that's been paid for these acquisitions. And as at the end of 2024, all of these assets have already paid back in free cash flow, which is huge. And you know, in excess of $2.5 billion of value has been created essentially through M&A. And what's super exciting as well, and one of the deals that we have done, out of the 5, one of them was funded using our paper. You know, we're all about—
So your shares?
Exactly,
you
through
shares,
our shares. Yeah. We're all about you know, our value per share growth. So when you have to issue paper, you have to look at something very, very closely because you don't want to dilute your shareholders down very much. But essentially, you know, the company that we took over, which was the Black Pearl Resources company, the one that I'd mentioned I was working for in my earlier years, was trading at a much more significant discount from a 2P net asset value perspective relative to IPC. So we bought into that discount. We issued around 80 million shares at that point in time. And you know, that's been a huge part of our organic growth story going forward because they had a lot of producing assets, but they had a lot of contingent resources as well, namely at this Blackrod asset. And so now we're exploiting that. There was no value assigned to that in the deal. And through all the buyback programs that we've been doing, there's only been 5% dilution just from the shares outstanding. All of our acquisitions have been quite accretive, but from a shareholding perspective or shares outstanding, there's really been minimal amount of shares issued or net shares outstanding as we stand today, and we're going to continue buying back our shares provided our share price stays suppressed.
By my calculation, some point in 2025 your share count is going to be back to where it was when you were listed and the company is so much bigger. So
exactly, it's getting close.
Congratulations for that. So you've mentioned Blackrod a couple of times. You've also used the concept contingent resource. Why don't you explain what a contingent resource is, and then let's move on to Blackrod.
Absolutely. So in terms of contingent resource, essentially it's a lower classification than 2P reserves. It means that you need to make ultimately a commercial decision. It's got to be economically viable in order to book those contingent resources into reserves, and you got to have a development plan to exploit those, essentially. And so those 2P reserves, they're in your development plan. They're either already producing or to be developed, and you have a firm plan to go out and mature those resources. And so when we sanctioned the Blackrod project in early 2023, and before even getting there, that asset has 1.3 billion barrels of recoverable resource, which is a significant amount to call a field that's greater than a billion barrels an elephant field. So it's very, very big. The phase one development, when we sanctioned that in early 2023, just matured around 220 million barrels out of that 1.3 billion barrels into 2P reserves. So with that, we brought that into our net asset value, which at the time in early 2023 represented around 800 million USD in NPV 10. And so not a single dollar of value is assigned in those, you know, other billion barrels of contingent resources at Blackrod. So if you invest in IPC, you know, sure, you're getting, you know, there's around $3 billion in net asset value, but then there's a lot of value that's not taken into account in any of our corporate cash flows or our net asset value calculations from the contingent resources. So very much an upside component within the portfolio, and which will be exploited through future phase expansions at our Blackrod asset, where we have approval to go to 80,000 barrel per day, regulatory approval, and we're starting with a bite-sized development approach going to 30,000 barrels per day, which we expect first oil to come in 2026, and we're about two-thirds of the total spend there as at the end of last year.
Yeah, I think it's been probably a little bit of an overhang for the stock, this huge project you have, but you're slowly, you know, we have line of sight to first steam, so that looks to be on good track.
Absolutely right. And, you know, we've seen it time and time again, you know, whether it was, again, through these Edvard Grieg or Johan Sverdrup developments, or even if we look on the mining side in Lundin Gold, you know, in Ecuador, there's a big gold mine that the Lundin family has a controlling position in this vehicle, and it's called the Fruta del Norte asset. And this project, which was something that, you know, was a distant site to be developed, it ended up being acquired for around $240 million through Lundin Gold. Of course, we're the major shareholder at the time there. And going through the development period, you know, the stock might have been around $4 a share, and as once it starts coming online, it you know, goes multiple hires, and today it's really a world-class gold mine, and it's, you know, the stock's around $30-$35 a share Canadian. So there's been a lot of value created, and again, it comes to that, you know, that long-term approach and having the right people around you and understanding, obviously, the guts and the asset quality that you have in front of you, and then making those kind of bold contrarian moves, say, well, if no one's developing, I think we should develop this if it's, you know, more cost effective and bigger value can be created through that rather than acquiring producing assets.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the capital markets today are quite skeptical about oil companies which are reinvesting. The market values them primarily on free cash flow, and which of course encourages companies to invest less, and you're going down a completely different route.
Totally, yeah. You can see, you know, I feel like, especially in Canada as well, it can be a bit short-sighted in terms of how, you know, target prices are considered, which usually, you know, looking at a short-term cash flow multiple. And so if that's how you're evaluating IPC and you're looking at a 2024, 2025 cash flow multiple or free cash flow numbers, you're missing the entire story, because, you know, our cash flow is going to be twice as high as it is relative to 2024 in a few years time. So if you're able to look past that and have that patience, you know, should be rewarded on the back end of that.
Yeah. And, you know, so it's incredible because how quickly time flies, but, you know, this Blackrod project has been a huge investment for you, but, you know, we're getting pretty close to the point where the company is going to be producing enormous or prodigious amounts of free cash flow. What are your plans for that?
Yeah, it's a great question. We're looking forward to that. And, you know, it's a multi-year build, so it's around 3 to 4 years, and being, you know, as close as we are, where we actually were just there with the board of directors before Christmas. We had a site visit to the asset. So, you know, a ton of packaged equipment and the facilities are being erected. All the teams gave us a thorough walkthrough. All the drilling's going very well, and construction activities to really see it live in person is super exciting. And so we sit well positioned to be able to deliver this project on time and on budget at this time. And there hasn't been a true greenfield development since around 2017 in Alberta. So it's a big move, and you know, provided everything's delivered on time, I think it'd be really good. And the follow-up question you had there,
what's next?
So I mean, in the next 5 years, or between 24 and 2028, we expect to generate between $900 million in free cash flow at $75 Brent, to $1.8 billion in free cash flow at $95 Brent. And so, and we look at the next 5 years after that, through 2029 through to 2033, we look to generate between $1.75 to $2.8 billion in free cash flow between $75 and $95 Brent. And so,
which is more than your current market cap.
Which is much more than our current market cap, exactly. So when we're going to be flushed with cash, you know, it's going to put us in a great position to, you know, really have the optionality to have, you know, enlarged shareholder returns, be able to have a bit of a war chest and have extra flexibility to either grow through M&A or also look to build out future phase expansions at Blackrod. So, you know, we have a really good portfolio with a tremendous amount of value that can be created. Ultimately, you know, we do look to grow beyond our existing portfolio, but you know, we're gonna be very disciplined in terms of how we approach that. And so, you know, when we're looking at growing through acquisitions, we've got to look at buying back our own stock or developing our own projects. How does it compete with that to take it to the next level? So a lot of optionality within the portfolio, and upon Blackrod coming on stream, I think it'll put us in a new position to be able to grow the pump company and take it to new heights once again.
Yeah. How do you think about share buybacks?
Share buybacks, we try and keep it quite simple, to be honest. We measure our intrinsic value based on our 2P reserves, which arguably could be a bit conservative given all the contingent resources that I had mentioned earlier. And so provided we're you know, not trading at our net asset value, and we're around $1.5 billion market cap right now, so really we're buying our stock back for 50 cents on the dollar. So with the family being around a 33% shareholder, and of course, you know, all shareholders, they do, it's nice to get cash back. However, you know, an understanding that the value that can be created through buybacks and buying, you know, your stock back for 50 cents on the dollar versus $1 going out the door towards dividends, you know, the value that can be created is much more significant through the buybacks in that form. So, you know, ultimately, we would like to harvest cash flow out of this entity through dividends to the shareholders. But given the resource that we have in the portfolio makeup, it's very long life assets that we have. So we have a 27-year reserves life index, which means we could essentially keep our production flat for 27 years just based on our 2P reserves. Again, nothing considered in our contingent resources. So having that longevity, flat production profiles, long recovery factors is really attributable to this heavy oil that we have. And it also allows us to be able to say, okay, well, let's keep buying back if we're not fairly valued. And we can do that for multiple years. And ideally, we will compress that discount. And then at that point in time, when we're trading at a premium, we'll look to hit the dividend button. But if we don't ever get there, we'll virtually go stealth private through our continuous buyback program. So.
Yeah. We love to see buybacks. Dividends are great, but the problem is we pay tax on them, and then, you know, so every dollar the company, you know, distributes, maybe, you know, 70 cents arrive with us. Whereas when you buy back stock, there's no sort of tax leakage, and on top of that, if you're buying it below intrinsic value, you're actually getting more than a dollar for every dollar you return.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, and especially no capital gains tax in Switzerland is ideal as well.
Yeah, maybe you can encourage your friends at Aker BP to go down that route as well.
Yeah, I could tell you some people are pushing for that, yeah.
So I think there was some surprise when people saw an oil company show up in my portfolio. I've always been super focused on family-run businesses, so for me, IPCO is a perfect investment, but there was nevertheless some surprise. And you know, I think that was probably connected to being oil, to it being an oil company, and especially maybe the younger generation. If I see my daughters concerned, understandably, about climate change, which we all know exists and is a terrible thing, but we also need oil. Maybe you can speak to that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's an industry that's been under a lot of duress, let's say, and not necessarily the flavor of the day from an investment perspective, given a lot of the scrutiny that it's received, especially pre-COVID period. A lot of that, I believe, is a little bit unfounded. I think there's a lot of scrutiny on the emissions side of things, but you know, there's a lot of technological innovations that will continue to progress through time to make operations more efficient and less emissions intensive. And you know, once COVID took place, and of course, you know, the tragic war that unraveled in front of us, you know, energy security became a bigger theme. And we're also, you know, generally seeing a pendulum shift a little bit from more of a socialist view from major the global economy, I would say, in general, and now going back to maybe a little bit of a different view. And so when I think of oil and gas growing forward, and oil specifically, demand continues to grow every year here. And so, you know, with demand growing and with population growth coming from emerging markets, developing nations and societies that maybe haven't had, you know, some of the economic prosperity, dense forms of reliable energy are extremely important to be able to take that next step. And so, you know, whilst the world is a very complex place and there's different stages of growth, depending if you're in the Western world or in other areas, but ultimately the biggest cities forecasted in 2100, some of the names you don't even really recognize because they're coming from different places in Africa and Middle East and in Asia. And so, you know, with respect to that, we see demand growth being strong coming from those places. You know, there might be a little bit of demand weakness coming from the Western world, but overall, you know, the major rating agencies anticipate demand to grow, to continue to grow for the foreseeable future. And there's not a new shale revolution discovery happening in the U.S. overall. So, you know, we've seen some growth coming from the U.S., but it is general consensus that it looks to be overall plateauing. And then, you know, with that shaping up, where is a lot of the supply going to be coming from? There's been a lot of lack of investment in prior years as well. So, you know, we believe that this shapes up to be a great space overall to continue to invest in, because it's not a replaceable source at this point in time. And so I think people are starting to understand that you can't flip a switch yep. to do the energy transition and switch to an alternative source. It's also because oil has so many different byproducts coming from it. And if you think about gas, you think about this AI boom, this technology boom, you know, where is this all? It all requires tremendous amounts of energy, right? In order to build out grids and to get, you know, power supply, in order to go through all these technological advancements and go through machine learning, you need a lot of energy. And so I think the overall oil and gas space is going to be re-rated in time, is my personal belief. It makes up around 10% of the earnings in the S&P 500, yet is trading at half of that level. And overall, you know, you can do it in a socially responsible way. And I think there can be continuous improvements in the industry through time to become less emissions intensive.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great point that the world needs it. And, you know, when I was in East Africa with Francis, we went to Uganda, and Uganda's had a big oil find, I think close to the border with the DRC. And, you know, aid agencies won't let them develop it. But of course, you know, people have motor cars there, and so they end up having to, you know, export it and then import the stuff from elsewhere. It's incredibly inefficient.
Yeah, no, another country like that, which has been unfortunate, Canada, is similar in terms of they haven't really done a great job from a federal government standpoint to really truly unlock the resource potential. And it's, you know, one of the most highly regulated, ethically sourced and cheapest energy sources that exists in the world, from oil and gas, but also in the mining front. And there's been a bit too much regulation constraining that. And so, you know, Canada produces around 5 to 6 million barrels of oil per day. And we sell a lot of this crude to the States because it's largely landlocked. And then we buy a lot of the refined products coming back. So, you know, there's a lot further potential, I think, to go in Canada. And we're seeing, you know, a government switch there that's likely to come. The election is in October of 2025, where the Conservatives are leading that. So I think that's a great thing for the industry overall, and also for IPC. It's coming on at a perfect time where, you know, we're fortunate there has been an extra pipeline that's come on stream to take away extra capacity called the TMX pipeline, which is adding 590,000 barrels per day of extra egress capacity within the Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin. And so tightening differentials are happening. We're having a shift in government, which should be more pro-industry. And this is all happening when our major growth project is about to come online. So it's perfect timing.
Yeah. There's been one or two political changes south of the border in Canada. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, that's definitely an interesting one. And I am on my, you know, Twitter and X account. So I think you've got to be braced for a lot of tweets coming from Trump in the coming 4 years, which should be quite interesting. And, you know, he's going to have quite an impact overall. I mean, there have been things like tariffs that have been mentioned that he's going to be, you know, intending to put on place. It's also been a mention that it would be assigned to Canadian oil in terms of the imports coming in. You know, I'd be personally surprised if he carries through with that, because I don't think that would be a net positive for either party. It ultimately would mean they'd have to pay more for the oil coming in, so they'd either have to push that on to the consumer through increasing the price in the product, or, you know, find another means in terms of trying to maintain their margins or ultimately eat into the refining margins overall. But I think it's going to be an interesting time. I think on the positive, you know, hopefully can help and support to get a resolution with the war that's going on in Ukraine and also in the Middle East. And I think overall in the short term, as it relates to oil and gas prices, there's a bit more of a skew to the upside given some of the sanctions that are intended to be enforced in the likes of Iran, also in Venezuela, and then now we've seen in Russia as well, that's gonna happen. So I think in the short term, there could be a skew to the upside, and we've kind of been seeing that as well in the recent price swing since the start of this year.
I think I'm going to ask one more question and give the audience the opportunity to ask a few questions. But, you know, I've had the privilege to meet many of the executives at International Petroleum, including Rebecca and Christoph, who are here today, but also several of the executives at some of the other Lundin Group companies, at you know, some of the copper businesses and the diamond, the gold. And they all seem to be very much cut from the same cloth, very much no nonsense, non-political, roll up your sleeves, get things done type of people. How do you do that?
Yeah, it's a great question. We're super fortunate to be surrounded with such good people. I mean, especially myself and the company. You've mentioned Christoph and Rebecca, and I mean the wider team that I have around me. There's no I in team, so it's all about the people and really empowering the people to take those forward. A classic, you know, statement is you could have a great asset and a poor management team, and, you know, not create a lot of value and actually destroy value, or you can have a decent asset and a great team and create a lot of value. And so, you know, what it comes down to is, you know, skin in the game is obviously important, proper incentivization, but also fostering a culture of togetherness and knowing that we're in this in the long term and not looking to be super bureaucratic and bogged down with processes. I think those are some of the key ingredients that make it an environment where people want to stay in and stay within the Lundin Group. And so we're super fortunate to have been surrounded with such good people and to be able to retain those people. And, you know, that's going to be a core focus to have going forward, because we can't do it without the team.
Yeah, I mean, the people I met all were like super keen to have, you know, small salaries, but as much stock in the companies as they could possibly have. And, you know, I think it speaks to the belief they have in the business. And, you know, that's worked out very well. Many of them have been with you for decades and they've become wealthy alongside your family. And that's the best possible way to take people with you if everyone's being successful together.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's been quite a change. You know, in the early days, we didn't really have the capital markets or the reputation to be able to finance projects forward, bring them through to development and into operations. And, you know, as you would make a discovery, and we'd want to do those things, but we really wouldn't have the kind of business acumen, if you will, and the size of a team and company to be able to do that. So there's been kind of a big growth shift where we've grown these companies, grown the people within them, and be able to take things to the next level. And, you know, of course, having some successes along the way makes people that much more fired up as well going forward.
Awesome. Okay, so if my daughters are around, maybe they wouldn't mind coming forward to grab the mics. Is Amelie and Ollie there? Oh, and we've even got Tommy as well. Tommy, why don't you come and help out? round of applause for Tommy and Ollie. I think they're just there. I hope the mic's alive. If not, I can give you my one. You better keep yours, because I think probably two. So who'd like to ask the first question? Thank you so much for doing that.
So thank you for being here, and it was very interesting to listen to you speaking about your business and the origin from your family. And my question is, so I think the investment case is very compelling for what you said, half the net asset value and probably market cap equal to the free cash flow generated in a few years ahead with low long-term debt. So I'm curious about how you think about downside when you make acquisitions and when you look at the at your business in a general way. So on a balance sheet level, on an income statement level, so your free cash flow is going to be produced also depending on the price of oil. But then you also know that if the oil price goes down, some suppliers are going to go out of business or not produce as much. So there is some protection there. So for us investors and not experts in the business, how would you help us think about downside risk in your business?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, number one answer to risk, I guess, being in the space is going to be commodity price. You know, that's something, of course, we can't control. It's very unpredictable.
You know, didn't catch it. What type of risk?
Commodity price risk. Yeah, exactly. So oil prices in general or gas prices. And so, you know, one thing that helps in knowing that if you're looking to do an acquisition, of course, we're running a range of sensitivities, down price sensitivities or higher price sensitivities to see, you know, how robust that opportunity is under varying pricing levels. And so like that's got to be the number one biggest risk. And so, you know, what you want to do when you're managing the business, of course, is, you know, have a setup where ideally you're an operator of your assets as well. So operating your assets mean you can really dictate your destiny. And so if prices are changing on you, having the ability to pull the lever to ramp down activity or ramp back up quickly if prices move so you can capture those good prices is a key attribute. But you don't always get that luxury in terms of being the operator of the assets. Fortunately, within IPC, we're the operator of pretty much all the assets that we have within the portfolio. And so those are some key components, I would say.
Great question. Thanks for that. Next one's over there, Ben.
Hi, how are you? I have a question about natural gas prices in Canada and your <Uh-oh>. thoughts on natural gas market in Canada and also its role for IPCO in the coming years, because you're both a producer, you know, it's an output, but it's also an input. It's hard for me to understand why, you know, the prices are so low, and what if you could talk about the economics for the marginal producer? Thank you.
Yeah, another great question. And so natural gas prices in Canada have been very, very suppressed. I mean, right now, winter season, you do see gas prices go up a little bit. It's around $2 Canadian per GJ. And in the States, you're looking at around $4 or so NYMEX per MMBTU. In Europe, or you're looking at gas prices that are, you know, double that or in excess of that. So, you know, there's a huge arbitrage win that you can do if you're able to get access to Canada. And leading into that is the Shell LNG project, the LNG Canada project on the west coast of British Columbia, which is supposed to add around 2 BCF of extra demand. And so there is an anticipation for that project to be starting up and online and getting LNG out by 2024, and that hasn't happened, and so it's slipped to the right a little bit in terms of the schedule overall, and we should see positive signs coming in 2025 to help improve the overall conditions there. But as a result of producers ramping up their production and also a little bit more moderate winters the last 2 years, this has led to bloated storage levels well below the five-year average, which again has corresponded to lower prices overall. So we're cautiously optimistic looking forward to the back half of 2025, largely in line with the forward curve, and also looking beyond that in the more longer term, there's a big announcement out of Alberta around data centers where they want to spend a significant amount, I believe $10 billion or so, on data centers. And so this is some of the cheapest gas that's around. It's a very environmentally responsible jurisdiction, heavily regulated, so it makes a ton of sense to be able to do that. So that should be more constructive and positive for a longer term outlook in Canadian gas in general for benchmark pricing. As it relates to IPC, so about one third of our mix, production mix, is natural gas weighted, coming from our Suffield asset in Southeast Alberta. As you rightly noted, we are net long gas, meaning that we sell more than we produce. We'll be going into more of a balanced position come 2030 to eventually a net short position. It's a nice to have when you're physically hedged as such, but it's not as big of a component or a concern. We're not as sensitive to gas prices overall. Now, if we're able to acquire another asset and push that vertical hedge out for more years, that would be fantastic, but we tend to be a bit more of a focused on oil type of company.
Norman, at the front here. Yeah, why don't you take my...
Well, thank you very much. And as value investors, we are always concerned about who are the competitors and what is your long-term defendable competitive advantage. So what do you do better than the others? Are you more audacious or better in operations? So could you give us some color on that kindly?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and you know, it can be a bit of a needle in a haystack when you're looking to invest in a company in the oil and gas space, because there are so many. But I think, you know, there aren't so many that have an owner-operator mentality where you have a cornerstone shareholder that, you know, represents in excess of 20% of your stock, that really, you know, is aligned with your management team and pushing that forward, that can allow the company to pursue longer term value creation developments like what we're doing in the Blackrod project versus seeking, you know, short term gains or just focusing on free cash flow or dividends and coming right back to the shareholders. And so by having that and also having your management team invested as such in a way that, you know, they're not just looking to collect a salary, we're here for this and have a lot of skin in the game in terms of equity exposure, I think that's one of the attributes. Competitors, I mean, you're gonna be looking at, you know, this is a junior space or to intermediate space based on our size of a company. So, you know, there's a lot of competitors out there, will it be European side or Canadian and oil and gas side. But, you know, when you look at the track record of delivery, what's really important as a publicly traded company is what you say you're going to do, you go out and do it. And so we are, you know, consistently delivering within guidance, whether it be on production or costs or cash flow forecasts year in, year out. So a level of credibility is very important. And then having that, you know, significant resource life in front of you is something that some Canadian peers have, but you don't really see this production growth coming from Canadian oil sands peers relative to the size of company that we are. So, you know, we are deliberately investing in buybacks as well as a growth project at Blackrod. Therefore, some of our production is naturally declining, but our production decline is very low at less than 10%. And so when we look at the forward production growing to an excess of 65,000 barrels of oil equivalent per day, if we assume roughly a 10% decline rate from 24 to 25, our 25 production going to 27 production, you know, we're talking at an excess of 55% in production growth, which is quite significant. So you're not going to find too many companies that have those attributes in the peer group.
Yeah. Very good. Yeah. And yeah. Can you expand on the family aspect?
On the family aspect, in what sense? Sorry?
Yeah, you said, I mean, you're owner operators. Your grandfather started, if I get it correctly.
Yes.
Okay, so your father and then you and your, is it your brothers or,
yep,
or your cousins?
Exact brothers.
Okay, and how are you operating together? I mean, some families from Uruguay to Finland, fourth generation, some 2 kilometers around the Zurich church. So different families, different approaches. What is your approach?
Yeah, no, it's and thanks for elaborating on that question. And, you know, a famous saying is by the time you go to the third generation, that's when, you know, the wealth can be destroyed in a family related industry. And, you know, we're all extremely competitive individuals, and that's just added fuel to the fire overall, and hasn't really been by design. But fortunately, we're spread out in such a way where, you know, my brothers and I are focused on different companies, so there's some overlap, and then there's, you know, consistent meetings happening throughout the year to make sure everyone understands what's going on. So essentially, Energy Hub located in Geneva, where, you know, I'm predominantly focused on. Of course, IPC is my number one priority. I'm also on boards of Shamarin Petroleum as well as Orin Energy, and then the mining companies. The headquarters are based in Vancouver, so a couple of my brothers over there managing the mining companies more so. And so, you know, when you have that kind of cornerstone shareholder and family that understands the guts of how this industry works and, you know, how arduous and challenging it can be, and have that long-term vision, you know, it makes us, let's say, a bit more sympathetic relative to maybe other types of shareholders out there in companies. But overall, you know, we're always striving for continuous improvement. We're always challenging, why aren't we doing this? Why aren't we doing that? And, you know, seeking and holding people to a very high standard to try and, you know, maximize the value creation for all our shareholders.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I had the privilege to meet three of the four brothers. The fourth missed lunch because he was closing a $5 billion deal with BHP. So I guess he gets a pass. But I hope we can do. But they're all equally driven. It's really quite incredible given the success of the family. So we've got about just a couple of minutes left. So I'll take one more from the room. Is Nick Chisco here? Do you have any from? Should we take an online? Okay, so let's get to one more. Dan, why don't you have one, and maybe we'll try to get one more after this. Maybe if you could keep your
opportunity. Thanks, Rob. You know, I suppose there are capital allocators that have good outcomes, and there are capital allocators that have poor outcomes. And you said you're operating in an industry that's incredibly unpredictable. It's very volatile. So among the universe of capital allocators that have had good outcomes, how do you distinguish between those that are lucky and those who are good capital allocators that are going to be able to sustain good capital allocation into the future?
It's a great question, and of course, you know, we all have the vision to create this huge amount of value and allocate capital accordingly, and, you know, we're fortunate to have, you know, different vehicles that have done similar things in the past and be able to kind of follow that. But every single company, every asset, you know, all people are different than one another. So you got to really create a plan and a capital allocations plan that's specific to your company. And so for us, you know, trying to maintain a strong balance sheet is super important because of the unpredictability and overall prices. You know, when you have major capital expenditure or debt maturities coming up, you know, we might be a little bit more defensive and look to hedge benchmark prices. You know, traditionally we do like to give our investors exposure to higher prices, but, you know, we have to think differently when we're spending a lot of money or debt maturities are coming up. So I think just managing your portfolio accordingly, keeping a strong balance sheet, and then understanding what you have in your portfolio in terms of your cash flow generation and the long-term profiles that come with that.
So we'll take one last question. I see about 15, maybe even 20 hands go up. I've been biased towards the front, so maybe we take one from the back, towards the back. Ollie, you've got one? Perfect. And then we'll close after that. But Will and his team are here the whole weekend, so there'll be plenty of opportunities to ask your questions.
Hey, Will, thanks for making the time. Just wanted to see if you could elaborate a little bit on the hedging front. I mean, obviously you all share details in your quarterly reports and everything, but just your general philosophy on that and when it's right to kind of protect your downside versus give investors more exposure to the commodity.
Yeah, thanks for that. And, you know, it's something we traditionally aren't big on hedging, like to give all our investors exposure to the commodity prices. But, you know, when we're in a situation where we're spending a lot of capital, we're growing a net debt position, or there's a major debt maturities coming up. Those are the type of conditions where we open up and we're a little bit more, you know, I guess open to hedging essentially. But also what comes into that, of course, we're monitoring the macro conditions every single day. And it is difficult to form a view. When we think about what's going on right now in the world as it relates to oil prices, you know, we believe we're range bound. Okay, and so OPEC, you know, they're claiming there's around 5 million barrels per day of spare capacity on the sidelines. You know, I personally think it's a little bit less than that, but nevertheless, if prices go on a tear, it's going to be tough for, you know, that alliance to keep those barrels on the sidelines. And so therefore, you know, if we hit triple digit oil prices in the short term, sure, it might hit there briefly, but then I would imagine, you know, barrels would come back onto the market as such to suppress higher prices, and similarly lower prices if those are to come. You know, I think OPEC is going to have a big part in trying to play that in order to manage their budgets. They want to see healthy oil prices as well. So, you know, we don't have a specific hedging policy that forces us to hedge in place, which is nice to have. It allows us to be opportunistic. So when we form a view and we want to hedge, whether it be differentials, currency, commodity price, you know, we're able to get a hold of our audit committee quite quickly. Of course, you know, we'll form our view, we'll get maybe expert opinions in as well, and then go and lock it in. But we like to not, we try not to do too long term of hedges, just typically one year out at a time.
Fantastic. So, Will, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Rob.
So we're going to break now for 30 minutes, and it'd be great to see you all back here at 10:30 for the Q&A with me and Andreas.